DMVA is called to order. Present are Representative Lynn Chirigato and Representative Ramrus. We're here for an overview on aviation safety. And in particular, we have a presentation by Mr. Steve Colligan of eTerra. Mr. Colligan, would you kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and what eTerra means? And then we can move on. I know it's a company. I know. But a little bit about what it does, and then we'll move on.
Well, Chairman Gatto, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come here and present today and just spend a few moments with you to kind of brief you on what's called the Alaska Aviation Safety Program. I'm Steve Culligan, president of eTerra, technically electronic earth, digital mapping technology integration firm. There's been a primary contractor on this project since 2001, as it started as a NASA-funded research grant through the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to use remote sensing technology, basically satellite and other technologies, to assist the state in different facets. And we partnered with Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to use that technology to apply towards search and rescue and aviation safety. Alaska's history is, as far as aviation safety, has been quite dramatic, and we can spend a few minutes and go through a presentation in that regard. You know, why is it important? Obviously, our statistics in aviation, and I know, Mr. Gatto, you're a pilot and the like. As far as we have the largest general aviation base of all states per population, and you know, unfortunately, we fly between mountains instead of over mountains here in our state, and and unfortunately, the statistics are not great. Over the past 10 years, you know, there's been a fatality on average every 2 weeks. There's plenty of NIOSH statistics, and 10% of the national air carriers and commercial pilots account for 35% of the aviation accidents. You know, contributing factors, you know, we as a state have the best and worst of everything. That makes us a great research and development area, but it also makes for challenging transportation, you know, extreme terrain and weather. We also have, there's lots of interest and love with aviation as far as with our state and getting out to resources or fishing, et cetera. But we have inexperienced pilots that are unfamiliar with Alaska flying conditions, also driven a commercial arena where we have people coming in to work on getting their hours that come from the lower 48 that aren't necessarily familiar with the terrain and other aspects of flying in the state. So a large pilot turnover, and you try and gather knowledge from bush pilots and old pilots, but a lot of old, bold bush pilots don't exist. And the old adage. But just like other elements of our culture, bush pilots and senior aviators have a wealth of knowledge about aviation and safety and flying mountain passes and weather conditions, just like is equivalent to native culture and language that needs to be passed on to help out other aviators, especially new aviators that can afford a plane but don't necessarily have the thousands of hours of experience in a particular pass. That backed up by statistics, you can see that the trend over the last, since 2000, implementation of several aviation safety programs in coordination, that fatalities and air crashes have been decreasing, as well as total fatalities and fatal air crashes. through the program, we've developed different products. Number one, in 2001, Merrill Pass was documenting different conditions when you're flying over the hump. There's different wind conditions, and when the weather comes in quickly and the cloud barrier ceiling lowers, you get disoriented, and there's plenty of aluminum on the hillside in several areas there that prove the weather conditions and the lack of experience. So we documented some of that. We've also put together, along with Medallion Foundation, one of our coordinating partners, a actual training data set for the Iditarod Air Force. Ironically, several years ago, the only crash on the Iditarod Air Force just happened to be one individual that didn't attend the training. But I don't know if that's ironic.
Tell you that Merrill and Rainey passes. Merrill, if you're a novel pilot, you will take the wrong turn and wind up in a canyon. It just looks wrong, and it takes someone flying with you to say, this is a dangerous spot, here's where you make your decision, right or wrong. And that experience is, it's not measurable. Because first time you bend an airplane, you could have had an awful lot of riders with you.
Absolutely. So you know, a lot of these data sets, and represent Dr. Chair, that you've explained, these data sets are visual training aids where you can put a pilot in danger without physically putting them in danger. And now with the cost of fuel, additionally, you can do it much cheaper, and it has all sorts of other added benefits. What you see before you are just some screenshots of photorealistic data sets that have been compiled using satellite imagery and real terrain and then when you layer it in with real weather and clouds, create some photorealistic data sets. We will have these down. We want to invite you to basically an open house tomorrow and at between 8 and 3:30 in the House Speaker's Chambers. We'll have a part of the simulator set up that's actually moved here from the out at the airport.
And joined by Representatives Kawasaki and Book. Did you get that? Tomorrow, 8 to 3:30, the Speaker's Chambers. We're going to fly airplanes. We're going to crash into the ground, hit mountains, and then go back to our work.
So, number one, the project started and was focused in 2001 by focusing with the debris field database that the Aviation Coordination Center, Rescue Coordination Center, basically tracks of where there's been crashes. And they primarily, the first line was a number of aviation corridors, highways in the sky, so to speak, where lots of general aviation is traveling, also where the weather changes quickly. But these are our highways to rural communities in general aviation, and it's too high to fly over a mountain and the like, and thus the problem. Other products that have been developed in communication is just getting pilots to understand the air spaces between general aviation, the float. We have, you know, in Anchorage area is a very complicated. People fly around the airspace just to avoid what is a very complicated airspace where we have, you know, the busiest international airport, we have the largest floatplane bases, largest general aviation bases, overlaid with a large military operation and access. And we've developed a set of products, training products, that are both used by the FAA tower operators to understand air spaces and the markers, as well as the military and red flag when they have new folks come to town. On the first couple days, there's usually quite a few violations of airspace because the foreign folks flying in red flag don't understand the commercial or general aviation airspaces that they're flying next to. The other products that have been developed here as of late in a operation and in coordination with other agencies are Q-based training products, both in Ketchikan and then here to be in Juneau, where the FAA aviation safety team has identified particular criteria and areas were of interest to them where they need to identify safety and provide training materials and criteria to improve safety. And that's through this process called Q-based training, where on a mile or 4 mile increments, there are visible cue points or identifiable landmarks that if they don't see those as part of their procedures, they return to base as part of their normal operating procedures and get certified to do that. So new pilots, et cetera. In Ketchikan and the like, it's more of a fixed wing operation, flying tourists and the like. In Mendenhall Glacier, it's in Ketchikan, it's going to be weather-based. You know, you can, the clouds settle in and different weather criteria flying between the mountains. In Mendenhall, it's a flat light condition flying up, escalating in white and low light conditions in a helicopter, a little bit different, but these training data sets are there to help facilitate training and operations and procedures for these operators and thus ultimately work with Medallion to get their certifications. The Medallion program has been key in providing some structure, and I think soon you'll see the tour operators demanding that their tour companies are certified at some test that their pilots and stuff have gone through some training, and they're unloading their tourists on trained, and companies are focused on safety. That leads us to the formation of this last year. It was called the Joint Project Office, where we have the Alaska Department of Transportation, and kind of moving forward, the project several years ago was transferred to the Department of Transportation from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs as it moved into more transportation and aviation focused beyond search and rescue. The partnership remains with the Medallion Foundation and NASA. So the research portion of this project, we'll explain, is focused with NASA. Also, NOAA, NIOSH has put in some funds as far as safety and occupational safety, and a partnership with the FAA, who is very interested in these very specific training data sets in Alaska to deal with their specific and tourism-related issues. In October of 2009, there was a signing ceremony by all these agencies. In this picture, you'll see folks from the Lieutenant Governor's Office, DOT, the FAA, NIOSH, Aviation Safety, and Mr. Nick Mastrocosta is here, who is the project manager that has kind of facilitated all of this coordination. On the research and development project, so mostly so far we've talked about products that are operational and how do we get people out there and do training. On the research and development project, there was a program developed in Alaska called Capstone, which was a accurate depiction and synthetic vision glass cockpit that kind of was prototyped and developed in Alaska. That was taken national, and the portion of that that is kept and being rolled out nationwide is called ADSB. It's the communication tracking kind of replacing and updating of things like radar stuff, but tracking communication to aircraft within the cockpit. There's great connectivity. The FAA is finally building out those facilities in Alaska. I know they've been to the legislature to help fund equipage of the plane, but the towers are now being built for the planes and the providers to be able to use that technology. We're also working on augmenting GPS as a primary location device. GPS is not fault tolerant, doesn't have a backup, and there's technology out there that allows us to augment that as a backup using time sequences and predicting the next movement of that aircraft in brownouts and other problems with GPS because either of a view of a satellite or other physical limitations. We're doing much of this with off-the-shelf devices and also testing using commercial cellular technology to augment in an inexpensive way wireless technology that's out in the villages and stuff now. ADS-B cuts out between 500 and 2,000 feet just based on its nature. If we can, the idea is if we can use cellular technology and the like as a backup and provide that tracking using just standard cell type technology or wireless technology, we can provide a backup all the way to the ground and provide other features, backups like weather cameras and other information.
Steve, that's a curious window, 500 to 2,000 feet. That's where the action is.
You're absolutely right. And there is no...
that's above ground or altitude?
That's above ground.
My it depends goodness. On the location of the GBT, the ground-based transmitter. Just the terrain will interrupt that. So a lot of locations, you're only going to have 54 ADS-B sites in Alaska. We've got several hundred villages out there. All of them, if they don't now have, will soon have wireless communications available. So we're looking at covering that envelope. So just the curvature of the earth limits the elevation. Maybe 200 here at the close of the GBT, maybe 500 or 2,000 further out, or if there's a mountain or something in between. The cellular, we can pick up and convey all the information that ADS-B needs. back and forth using the cellular network, so that coverage will be maintained all the way to the ground and on the ground too, which is also an issue.
And Chairman Gatto, I'll take the opportunity to introduce Frank McCreary, the Chief Financial Officer for eTerra, the business partner.
It's your boss?
My partner.
Partner. You're his boss? Same thing.
We're mutually accountable. So you raised a very good question, Chairman Gatto. And as a technology integrator in Alaska, I firmly believe these technologies and stuff apply nationwide. But we have some unique circumstances in the state of Alaska. We also have a very unique opportunity that, you know, people are looking for different types of economic growth and the like, but Alaska is a great place for research and development for that very reason. When you look at our extreme terrain, weather, we have great and bad telecommunications depending on where you're at. We can test these technologies without affecting millions of people on commercial services and the like. And so we've been very successful. And I'll move to the next slide. Chairman Gatto, you should be familiar with, in Palmertown, the New Horizons folks, telecom at the Palmer Airport, where we have partnered with New Horizons and Port Graham on the testing of these wireless technologies, and to basically build out and test a wireless aviation network topology to back up some of this other technology. And in Alaska, we've gotten a waiver to do that. Find the slide here. I don't have it. To do that basically between Palmer up to Talkeetna, where, you know, it's really illegal to use your cell phone in your general aviation airplane. Most people do it, and they sell headsets that integrate with that, even though it's illegal. But we are a few. We took us 3 years, but we had a waiver to be able to test that, and without modification, using and testing cellular sites. And what's funny is, you know, cell sites are made that they work in the ground about 3 miles. You can talk on your cell phone, you tower hop.
Really?
When you're in the air, you can hit a cell site as up to 100 miles away. It's more the problem of you're overburdening or hitting too many sites, and depending on which one's going to service you.
I know, coming out of Pass into Cook Inlet, you always dialed up your cell phone.
Yep.
Hi, honey, I made it through the pass. And yep. Because it worked so well. And
yep.
You didn't have to call FAA at all, just on your cell phone. And they said, that's illegal.
Yep.
And everybody said, so?
Yep.
Still calling
it's
home.
Kind of a oxymoron, but, you know, a lot of that came to light at 9/11 when there were several people in the one aircraft that were in contact with emergency services
right.
when the FAA didn't know where some of those planes were. And, you know, it's more seen as a distraction in the airplane, but now you're seeing that some of those private technologies. And what we're saying here, and this is the research component of this project, is that in Alaska, especially we're seeing the private carriers put out wireless technology that's superior to even what they have in Juneau or Anchorage, et cetera, first generation into some of these rural communities, can also be a great augmentation to aviation, getting weather camera data. You know, once a pilot has an hour and a half getting from the airport to a mountain pass, the more you're invested in time, the more you're driven to find a way to make it through. And if you can get some information, whether it's just text or other information about that mountain pass or weather conditions on the way, you know, there's just some natural drivers and people's investment time that just cause dangerous situations. And at the end of the day, the mission really is collectively to raise the bar, raise the awareness, and I think it's been very effective over the last 3 or 4 years. And the Department of Transportation and more so Nick Mastrodacosta, the project manager, done a great job of bringing the partners together. They're not all doing different things. We, as the technology portion, provide the data to the Medallion Foundation that has simulators statewide. They're out doing the training. We make their training program very desirable and photorealistic and very effective, while DOT or the FAA has through their aviation safety, their safety team program is focused on you know, at least currently on tourism-related accidents, where there is, we have a small window of time driven by a lot of customers that want successful flights, but there has to be some limitations and some criteria based on when to fly and when flying is safe.
Sure.
And pushing
what
them.
Caused the crash was weather, and because the crash has now occurred, the weather is deteriorating.
Correct. So you know, those are all good things as far as funding goes. In 2001, this started out as a actually it was supposed to be a $3 million appropriation, but part of the data collection started 4 days before 9/11, and part of it was finished 5 days afterwards. And those funds were capped as a federal mandate. And then the following year, worked with NASA directly to fund and work on the 13 mountain passes in coordination with NASA Langley and their synthetic vision program on those mountain passes. And then have developed out the wireless and other technologies, getting the waiver and doing the testing, some of the baseline research that hasn't been done, or is now done, but hadn't been done at the time. The other funding has been building out those data sets. Those data sets are used for all sorts of different mapping applications for all different divisions of the state. But the state is really, you know, talk about statewide mapping is a another three-hour discussion, but the reality is the information that has been collected in detail provides a photorealistic, which we invite you to come visit tomorrow. But now the federal partners are chipping in and sharing in those costs and a common vision and a common goal when it comes to aviation safety and kind of partnering to identify the hot issues. Everybody can't afford to do everything everywhere, and so by them coming together, not everybody gets everything they want, but they're moving in a common goal, not duplicating efforts. It's worked out real well. As far as funding goes, the state has pitched in funding either through the governor's budget or through legislative appropriation at a, you know, almost 20% to 80% state versus federal, and been very successful. You know, at the end of the day, when you put economics to it, unfortunately, just search and rescue cost or the value of a human life economic impacts calculated by NASA, et cetera, and ICER, it's very expensive. And if we can avoid take the search out of search and rescue and also reduce the overall impact by raising the bar and educating folks, and the community is very involved and wants to better itself. Alaska's been a safer place, and aviation is improved. And that's all I have at the moment, other than to make sure that I think you guys have an invite to the open house tomorrow, where we'll have a simulator and have some more technical staff here.
And the hours again?
It's from 8 a.m. to 3:30. We're actually setting up later this afternoon to make sure it's ready right away.
Going to be ready tonight?
We might be ready about 5 o'clock or so. We'll see. But
I missed my plane.
Okay.
You're trying to fly home, are you?
But if you have any questions, we'd be more than happy to answer those, and I really appreciate your time.
Just a comment. You know, my first plane was a T-craft. Mm-hmm. No flaps, no electrics, just hand prop. The radio was handheld, but the battery life was so bad, I'd put a car battery in the back and flew and went hunting, bought skis, and it was fabulous. And then you think back today, people would call you nuts. You've got to have a GPS and certainly a panel full of gyros, but you don't need it. But it is a risk.
Yeah.
I remember getting carburetor ice and going, how come this engine is so weak?
Yeah. One comment, just kind of have a couple pilots in our office and doing work, quite a bit of work in mapping in the lower continental U.S. In the aviation, you can go get a Garmin glass panel, and put it in the co-pilot's seat. And in Lower 48, what's affordable, what's fairly accurate, and it's a fairly good tool in your cockpit. In Alaska, it's affordable. It is not accurate because your GPS is fairly accurate. But the map underneath you can easily be a half mile or a mile off from where it shows you. Oh. And it will kill you. And trying to get people to understand some of the legacy problems that the state of Alaska has. Last night I was at a presentation about the Cook Inlet beluga whales and research, and Congressman Young was lamenting that in the 1950s, when he remembered that they mapped Tyonek and that whole area around there. And after that, she was talking, and said, Congressman, you realize that you're still using the data from the 1950s. It doesn't now meet national map standards. It's not as accurate, and it's pre-64 earthquake, and a lot of that has changed dramatically. And but in the state, those funds start in the east, move to the west, and never make it north. But all of a sudden, because of development, missile defense, the need for use for UAVs that have a higher demand for accurate terrain and the like, all of a sudden this digital data and these technologies, what used to, you could call it garbage in, garbage out, we still call it GIGO, but it's garbage in, gospel out. The technology is so easy and beautiful and convincing, but if you don't know where the data came from or how accurate it is, it will kill you. And so we're on a different mission of also trying to get the agencies to work together, federal, state, and others, to improve that as well. But in this case, we're focused on aviation safety and the critical areas of those highways in the sky.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Chairman.
Gatto.
I didn't see any in your presentation. I did have the pleasure of, going through your offices, and Frank and I are fairly close neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that ever separated us was Strawberry Road. At any rate,
say no more.
Yeah, it was a huge issue. At any rate, the thing that we did come together on is our concern over aviation safety in Alaska. And could you expound on how much of that is mapped currently?
Through the years, I believe we've got about 7% of the state when you totally calculate that out. There are other separate mapping initiatives that we see that will provide data. A lot of the expensive portion of this is collecting the accurate terrain and imagery that make a map, and whether that can be used for all sorts of feature extraction, whether you're at DNR or whatever. But in this case, we're buying licensing it, this project. But there's other mapping initiatives that Mr. Nick Mastrocasa from the State Department of Transportation and the Statewide Digital Mapping Initiative, SDMI, have pooled money together to basically collect from Fairbanks to the Canadian border, basically down to South Central as a first turn. And there's other initiatives to collect data that this project will benefit from. It will reduce the overall cost for developing future products, but the data is the largest cost. That is being done in cooperation, and that data will be available. And that will be a different presentation, but talk to Nick about. But that will be, approaching more 20% chunks to deal with commonalities, not necessarily in aviation, but the military operation ranges and other DOT efforts, et cetera. But as far as this project alone, I guess maybe I should ask Nick specifically remember the exact percentage of geographic coverage for the AASP versus?
For the secretary, we need a name identification. Nick?
I'm sorry. This
Nick
is
Mastrocasa.
Do you want to speak into the microphone?
Oh, sure.
And then give a slow pronunciation of your last name?
Absolutely.
Or spelling, because she's trying to copy it all down.
It's pronounced Mastrocasa, and it's spelled Mastrodicasa.
We knew that.
It's Italian. It means master of the house until you get married.
Yeah, that's a different subject.
Yeah. Okay, so I believe the question was how much of the state is approximately mapped right now, and there are two components of the mapping issue. One, it's all the base map, but you've got your elevation data, and then you've got your imagery, your satellite imagery. Right now, about 5% of the state has accurate elevation data at NPRA. Now, we'll be doing about 10% more this year, which is a partnership with the federal entities, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, USGS, BLM, NRCS, and a couple of others. They're contributing approximately $4 million against $2 million in state funding for the elevation data. Now, there is an RFP coming out in mid-March for imagery acquisition as well, which is $2 million of state money leveraged against $2.6 million of federal money. And that is a statewide effort. The digital elevation is also a statewide effort, but what we believe we can accomplish is about no more than 30 1-degree by 1-degree cells, which actually right there is kind of a representation.
What I'm pointing to is this, is, you know, we can probably get about,
those aren't 1-degree by 1-degree cells, they're bigger than that, but probably about 15 of those. So we'd be about 85% done with the elevation at the end of the summer, but we need to continue with this momentum.
And through the chair to Representative Book, I'd be remiss that tomorrow at the presentation we have an updated map that has all the boundaries of the data sets on a statewide display that we just got updated. I can get you an updated, smaller version of that map.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. State funding, the amount we've had and the amount we hope to continue.
State funding has been, started out as $500,000 match. This year requested, last year was requested $1 million, and it was cut back at the OMB and the governor's budget to $400,000 because of budget cycle. This year we requested $1 million and was cut back to $500,000. And that also goes against other federal matches. Still hopeful to get $1 million in funding, but it's currently in the budget at 500, I believe.
How many simulators in the state?
The Medallion Foundation, I believe there's 20-some simulators around the state. There's one here in Juneau. There's several.
Are they all the same size? Or
they have standardized them off of, which like tomorrow we'll have a triple screen, kind of an immersive screen. And then there's also, so most of them are a particular similar configuration at Nick's office at the DOT, where other pilots and operators come in and test pilots and do some interviews using those tools. It's a standard three-screen immersive display. But they also have a full-motion Super Cub at their main training data center off of Tudor Road in Anchorage, and a mobile helicopter training. That's a two-seat helicopter simulator in a trailer, and behind that is, inside the trailer, is an instructor station where they can simulate a rotor nick and other scenarios and decreasing oil pressure in the helicopter in this photorealistic environment for the helicopter operator in different scenarios. But majority of them are a particular configuration, but there's a specialty high-value, like I said, full-motion Super Cub for off runway landing scenarios, and a helicopter simulator for helicopter operators.
I was with the fellow who did the helicopter training, and he said, hey, I got to go to the bathroom. And in the time he was gone, I destroyed it 3 times.
Well, the great thing, I guess I can let you know about, Chairman, is that the P key on the keyboard, which usually isn't in a real helicopter, it is a pause. And that's what we use at the office. And then we also cheat with the Xbox interface to really get where we need to go fast.
Yeah, well, I've never flown a helicopter, but, you know, when you're flying an airplane, you go down the runway, you pull the stick back a little bit, and every time I pulled it back, I was heading for a mountain.
Mm-hmm. Just like real life.
Didn't want to just fly left or right.
It's just like real life.
Yeah. Well, fake life. I like virtual life where the cleanup cost is minimal.
Right. There you go.
Representative Booth?
Mr. Chairman.
I'm familiar, former experience with Civil Air Patrol, and we went through an exercise or maneuver of a prop strike, but I never heard of a helicopter nick. So could you go into a little bit of detail on
that? Yeah, I'm not
glossed over that.
I'm not the helicopter training guru, but in the helicopter simulator, the manufacturer has a little, rather than fumbling with a keyboard, there's a basically a program little panel that has different scenarios particular to a chip rotor or blade, et cetera, that the trainer can actually go through a standardized procedure sitting behind the pilots and monitor them, record the whole thing. But in this little training panel is a pre-recorded or predetermined scenarios that oil pressure can decrease over time, weather can fade over time, so kind of putting them into a dangerous situation that it's very realistic. And the particular rotor chip and stuff are maybe a little bit out of my domain of other than remote control helicopter flying, which gets wild and crazy fast. But it's what I'm referring to as a training panel that allows some standardization of scenarios that are particular to helicopter training and certification.
Thank you.
Crop chip is pretty bad, too.
Yep.
I guess there's some stories about these really old guys who landed in the snow and bent their prop, and they'd saw off the same piece on each end, and they'd have to wait for spring or something, and about a two-mile runway, come back, and they thought you were dead.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I was for a while. Great stories, but we're trying to prevent those stories with equipment.
Trying to prevent those stories, but at the same time, a lot of those experiences are great training scenarios. And if I just have a minute, when we first started, we had the benefit of having two very senior bush pilots, Orrin Siebert and Mathia Doyle. And Orrin's obviously been in Western Alaska and done lots of bush flying, and Mathia is an elderly lady that is still a certified flight instructor, works with the university, and a very instrumental part of wanting to improve aviation safety, and it was called the 99s, the Women's Flying Association. We also had in that panel two young gentlemen. One was a rescue helicopter operator pilot. The other was a C-130 navigator from out at Fort Rich. And we started showing these early on in the early days. That's half the resolution of what we can, fidelity that we can demonstrate today, or a quarter of the fidelity. We were showing Portage Glacier and the Portage Pass going around Turnagain up and over. And Orrin Siebert jumps up and starts yelling, very animated, "There's that rock, and if you don't turn to that rock," and we end up calling it Orrin's Rock. But he was going through this animated and very passionate, and that his experience, that if you weren't so far to the east side of that rock and the one side of the mountain, and the winds would blow in, and his friend died there at that rock. And, but the reality is that young guy says, "You know what? You identified that rock in that training data set, and I've got to go out there in 4 hours and rescue somebody, and I've never been there. This is a great tool for me to learn." He was worried that we were going to use the tool to encourage more people to go out there and fly, when the young guys, more like the new pilots, were trying to figure out how they get the experience and understand where they're going to go out and rescue somebody and pull them out of there, which started a whole different dynamic in the value of the data sets. And like I say, just like, our indigenous languages are around the state and all sorts of other things, that experience has value. And there's old pilots and there's old bold pilots, but there's no old bold pilots. Mm-hmm. But those experience of those skilled aviators is important in documenting that, and the weather conditions and other things that happen in the state, and these tools allow that to happen in a very inexpensive way.
Well, by natural selection, we're going to get rid of the oldest and the boldest. Yep. But we're left with the newest and the least experienced, too.
That's correct, and that's where these tools are very effective. And the reality is, you know, that we haven't moved the project there yet, but these are all based off Microsoft Flight Simulator, a $65 application.
That you can use at home.
And we're partnered with Medallion at the moment, and they're rolling that on, and have been doing a great job. And the commercial pilots that participate benefit because they get a break on their insurance.
Do you have a statistic? Because I've known Earl Payne. I don't know if you ever knew him.
I did.
Bush pilot, and Kenny Hughes, Bush pilot. And Earl Payne was my neighbor, and he was a guide, and I think he owned 100 Cubs because he'd go to America, buy a Cub, bring it back, and sell it. So a lot of the Cubs in Alaska came through Earl. But he said, until you've got 650 hours, you have no business flying a plane with any kind of confidence. And he referred to the term, you have to wear the plane. So I always thought of a seagull or something that, you know, is able to tuck wings in and balance itself in any kind of wind. And that's what Earl was talking about, that every little vibration in the plane, every little uplift in one wing, every little tail movement, when you feel it, you're okay. And he said that begins at 650 hours. I think that's a high accident time, 600 hours. A lot of people are feeling they're awful good by now.
Yeah, I don't think we have the statistics.
Overly confident. I don't have any statistics along those lines. So.
But I know the Medallion Foundation, unfortunately, they're not here, but there will be somebody here tomorrow at the training, at the simulator tomorrow.
So you're leaving town tonight?
Pardon me?
You leaving town
tonight? I'll be in town through Thursday.
Okay.
But the simulator will be set up tomorrow.
Questions?
And there is a simulator in Palmer at the end of the Palmer runway at New Horizons. And there's an area set up for general aviation use there as well.
So. Well, when I started, there were simulators, but they were at the flying services. And they were for people taking IFR lessons, but they were not available unless you were paying. And as a result, you just don't go because, you know, you're happy that you can already do this stuff.
Yeah, some more information about the Medallion program, but basically you sign up for their program as general aviation, and it's available to you free for general aviation to participate.
I have to take this.
Okay.
Can you just take it?
Right.
Mary?
I remember when I went to my aviation cadet flying reunion in Malden, Missouri. Flew, started out in T-6s down. I'd flown OT craft before with little heel brakes and the prop, like Carl, the chairman, was saying. And they had on display there the simulator that I used at Malden, and a little blue and yellow Link trainer. And you put the box over top of your head. It was just incredible. You know, we've gone from that to what we have today. And I've had an opportunity through the Dedalians actually go out and sit at the big FedEx simulator out there. And I was at the Medallion and did a little bit of that there, mainly the helicopter, because it helped me figure the thing out. But it just the progress that we've made from that little Link trainer to what we're doing today. And I know when I checked, I finally got a model airplane, an F-94C. I got down in my office. Somebody knocked tip tank off, but I'm going to put it back on. But, you know, no simulator, no nothing. And had set in the cockpit, did the blindfold cockpit check where you're pointing to dials and so on. The next morning, get in there, sit down, pat you in the back. Good luck, have fun. And you just take off of the thing, and, you know, most of us survived. So just, you know, what's it going to be 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now? It's just amazing.
Yeah,
and so much more safe than it is now, than it was back then. And I did not take flying lessons from Orville and Wilbur, by the way.
Well, you know, what you say is absolutely true. And the technology has evolved and in many ways, both from the data perspective and the fidelity of a photorealistic, immersive-type training situation, as well as a lot of simulators are procedure training and how to use equipment, especially on the large carriers, they're more procedure training. In Alaska, we're very focused on the visual flight training because we're flying between mountains. But the technology has both made it more affordable and just made it basically the computer gaming industry has driven that. And that same technology allows us to use Flight Simulator in Nome and be in Anchorage and do the, through a network operation, manipulate the training data set remotely. I mean, right now it's kind of hands-on, but the technology exists because of that scenario to
being able to flexibility. Yeah, being able to program in, you know, scenarios, problem scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing, like we usually just memorize a checklist,
mm-hmm.
or then you get the book out and you go like this, oh my God, you know, what page are we on here? And to do that as compared to actually living through it with these simulators and
yep.
put any kind of scenario you want to in there, basically. It has to be a lot, you know, a lot safer. So the first time it happens in air, you've already been through this procedure several different times, and not just by memory or by looking at some checklist.
Well, what's great about the technology, that's $65, and you can wrap millions of dollars of hardware around it, of course. But it has three modes. One is, you know, it just kind of ignores the crash. The other is it bounces off the mountain. And the other is a fatality when you see all sorts of sparks and stuff like that. The bottom line is you can put yourself in danger without physically putting yourself in danger, and you can go try a scenario without flying an hour and a half to be in the location to try that scenario and go through that.
And see if it works.
Et cetera. And it's not the fix-all elixir, but it's very beneficial. So.
I'd like to interject also the data sets that have been created are in use at the university for training students both in air traffic control and flying piloting. So they are used for that.
I see.
There's also something else I'd like to point out.
Okay.
If I could. If you look down at the lower right-hand picture, this is basically a flight test of the ADS-B over cellular integration, or the R&D side of the project. One of the ADS-B is great, it's fantastic, but the equipment in the aircraft can cost as much as $30,000, and it's mounted permanently into the aircraft, and it consists of a GPS, a processing capability, and basically a radio. What we're proposing is that you would use a handheld GPS that you could take out of the aircraft and use for hunting or fishing or hiking as well, a laptop or a notebook, and basically a cellular phone to get your data connection. None of them are committed to the aircraft, so they have dual purposes, and they'd be significantly less expensive for the prospective pilot to purchase and operate. In fact, they probably already have it, and it's merely a software solution at that point. ADS-B is really the chicken and the egg. You've got to have the users on board using the equipment, which means they have to buy the avionics in order to pay for the GBTs, which is the ground-based transceivers. The ground-based transceivers are no good without this, and this is useless putting it in your aircraft if there aren't the ground-based transceivers. So the cost has to come down on the avionics, and this is one way that we believe or we feel that cost can be driven down so that it can be, you know, affordable to the average guy, the average pilot.
Bob, any? Reverend Brook, any other comments? Reverend Rammers?
No, I just would like to say I appreciate you folks in the presentation mm-hmm. and your efforts. Those of us that know the importance of the aviation industry and the economics here and what it means overall for the state of Alaska really appreciate what you're doing. Those of us that are involved in private flying understand the nature of what it is firsthand. So all of these things wrapped up into public safety is a huge issue for the state of Alaska. And in your efforts, we hope that we're going to be able to partner with you and move forward in these endeavors in the state, in the federal government, and also with the partnerships that you guys are already starting to formulate. So thank you.
Just one quick comment. You mentioned on the commercial flying, like at the Medallion Foundation has an awards ceremony annually in October, November timeframe. And this year was kind of interesting. Taquan Air in Southeast was given an award, and they got up and said that, you know, they had an investment of time in this additional training and certification. But they actually were awarded a federal contract, a large federal contract for flying for the people of the Forest Service, and they weren't the lowest bidder. But because of their certification and their commitment to safety, had special qualifications that entity was interested in contracting to them because of the safety of their workers and the like. And it's created a different scenario and a different mindset in the commercial side that's kind of interesting. It's just a, we feel, a great thing in industry, and thank you very much.
Well, you know, flying is important every place, of course, but in Alaska, it has always had a very special significance up here in the development, if not the economic development of this state. Where would we be without the early bush pilots, and where would we be without, you know, the highways in the sky to get things, you know, the oil and the gas production? Hopefully we get a gas pipeline someday. Somebody might be flying down that gas pipeline, you know, check it out, as they do on the oil line. Had a very specialized work up here and great opportunity for somebody. But I want to thank you very, very much. For those of us who are pilots and those who are has-beens, it's just fascinating, and I want to congratulate you on your work. Our chairman, Reverend Gatto, had a call that he just had to take. So on behalf of the chairman and the other folks here, I'd like to thank you very much for your presentation.
I think
we'll try to make it down there tomorrow to try out your simulator. Hope you don't break it. And
we'll be there and have fun one way or the other. Come on.
Now, after we fly it the first time, we may cancel all of our other committee meetings and just continue.
You just have to bully the other guys out of the room later on. We're going to be here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
How's Mount Dane?